racing to introduce legislation to enact Biden's proposed cap on prescription costs, limiting expenses to $2,000 a year.
We can no longer tolerate companies like Novo Nordisk charging the American people $1,000 a month for Ozempic, a drug that costs less than $5 to manufacture, when that same exact product is sold in Germany for $59. $1,000 in America, $59 in Germany, unacceptable.
I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Hi, and welcome to the Labor Heritage Power Hour, a weekly radio show celebrating the cultural heritage of the American worker. We're a proud founding member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, laborradionetwork.org. I'm Chris Garlock.
And I'm Elise Bryant.
You know, we're talking about taking down these statues, and should they take them down or should they not take them down? But what about in our own house?
That's Terry Melvin, president of CBTU, the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Last year, the AFL-CIO changed the name of its main meeting room from the Gompers Room to the Solidarity Room. Terry tells us why. Plus, he shares his favorite labor song.
Then a preview of this year's DC Labor Film Fest, which launches on May Day. We visit with AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center director Todd Hitchcock and Abby Algar, director of AFI programming.
It's a really lovely film. And now apparently it is officially Ken Loach's final film because he's recently announced his retirement.
You'll find the complete DC Labor Film Fest schedule online on the Labor Heritage Foundation's completely updated website, laborheritage.org.
And that's where you'll also find the latest labor arts news there. Tons of cool labor arts events across the country. Plus, now you can get LHF merch, t-shirts, caps, mugs, and tote bags with the brand new LHF logo.
And on Labor History in 2.
The year was 1937. That was the day workers at the Hershey Candy Plant in Hershey, Pennsylvania, sat down.
Here are some labor arts news headlines from the Labor Heritage Foundation's weekly newsletter. Workers at a popular new and used bookstore in Richmond, Virginia, have officially joined UFCW Local 400. Shelf Life Books staff made history as the first unionized bookstore in the city, with the owners choosing to voluntarily recognize the union after every eligible worker signed authorization cards. SAG-AFTRA members have ratified new 3-year television and basic cable animation contracts covering voice actors with overwhelming support. Workers at the Universal Cinema AMC at CityWalk Hollywood in Universal City, California, have officially voted to unionize with the theatrical stage employees. After holding the picket line for nearly 3 weeks, unionized workers at the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art, MassMoCA, have successfully ratified a new contract that delivers victories on core member issues. And after more than 2 years of management slow-walking negotiations, the News Guild CWA, which represents Oxford University Press workers in the United States, is making plans for a potential strike. Members of Oxford University Press Union won their election in September 2021. And the bargaining unit covers roughly 150 staff in the New York metropolitan area. While negotiations first started back in February 2022, management at the largest university press in the world has refused to bargain, instead opting to fill U.S. vacancies by sourcing the jobs abroad. Further, workers say the OUP hasn't offered a fair deal on wages either. Current starting salaries are about $40,000, far from a livable wage for members living in New York City, making it more difficult for people underrepresented in publishing to enter the industry. Workers aren't deterred by these union-busting tactics, however, and are committed to getting a fair deal, even if it means striking. Those reports from the Labor Heritage Foundation's weekly newsletter. Sign up free on our website, laborheritage.org. Here's the show. We'll begin with our conversation with Terry Melvin, president of CBTU, the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists.
I thought we would just start out with when we last saw you was at the AFL-CIO Executive Council, and it was in the Solidarity Room, which has not always been the Solidarity Room.
Correct.
So I thought maybe you could tell the story of what it used to be and why it is now the Solidarity Room.
So what happened was forever, as long as I can remember, I should say, the Solidarity Room was named the Gompers Room. And I didn't really pay it any attention. Samuel Gompers was a labor leader from years ago, and he started the AFL, and, you know, it's a great thing, I guess. They named a room after him. And it wasn't until, you know, we started going through the, we started the Racial Justice Task Force. And on the Racial Justice Task Force, I am the executive director, and Alvina Yeh was a member of the task force, and she was from APALA. And as we were going through talking about all these issues and the issues affecting workers of color, Black folks and workers of color in the movement and outside of the movement, we had several meetings, and then she brought up the issue of the other thing was the issue of statues being taken down in the South and the struggle with that and what's going on with that. And one of the things about the Racial Justice Task Force is that we had decided that we need to look internally at our movement before we can tell people on the outside what they should be doing. How novel an idea, right? So as we were having a conversation, both at the Racial Justice Task Force meeting and at the Progressive Workers Coalition meetings that we were having, Alvina brought up the issue that, look, you know, we're talking about taking down these statues, and should they take them down or should they not take them down? But what about in our own house? You know, we've got this big room that everybody uses downstairs, and it's called the Gompers Room, and it's named after a man that was against people of Asian descent. I mean, he actually fought against people of Asian descent coming to the country. And how can we, you know, he had the Chinese Exclusion Act that he was fighting for back in the day. And oh, yeah. And so it's like, how can we have a room that the biggest room in the place that people come to use, and it's by a racist, right? So we took that both. I had the conversation with Fred Redman, and I had the conversation with Liz Shuler at two different times. But before I could get to Liz, Fred had already talked to her, and she hadn't even thought about it either until it was brought to her attention. And she immediately put together a work group to look at not just the Gompers Room, but to look at all the rooms and see who we had rooms named after in the building, right? So the Gompers Room definitely stood out as the one that had the biggest impact on us as a movement when we are trying to be all things to all people. And the committee recommended that we change the name from the Gompers Room to the Solidarity Room. And then the other thing that the committee recommended and the president had approved, which we have not got to yet, is while we name the room the Solidarity Room, What we're supposed to do is have Solidarity Room all over the room in the different languages. That's part two, right? And we haven't got to that part yet, but that's part of it also. It's not just called the Solidarity Room, but it's supposed to be seen as the Solidarity Room also. So we're going to be working on that part. But I mean, this is a testament to not just the work of the Racial Justice Task Force, which of course I'm very proud of, the work that we've been able to do, but the leadership of Liz Shuler and Fred Redman on these issues of import to all of our members and to make sure that our movement is welcoming to everybody. So I give kudos to them for giving us the space to really lift up these issues and to follow through on issues that are brought to their table.
I'd like you to reflect a little, if you would, wearing your CBTU hat, and also referring back to Black Lives Matter and where that's at now in terms of why these symbols matter, whether it's a statue that people want to take down or renaming a room, because I think some people want to say, well, you know, it's a name of a room. Who cares?
Well, I think it's reflective of if I am of Asian descent and I'm walking into a room named after somebody that I knew literally hated me and my culture, right? I'm not going to feel comfortable in that space. If I'm an African-American person and I'm living in a city that has statues, well, first of all, I've never understood how losers get statues all around this country. I don't know. They lost the war. I mean, they lost. So how did they get statues? But even taking it further than that, if I'm a Black person and I got to go up to this statue with this person that was trying to keep me enslaved in this country and was trying to break the country apart to keep me enslaved, I got a problem with that as a Black person, right? So you can't say that you're being inclusive and you understand who I am and what I represent if you want to keep this statue of this loser who was trying to take away my rights, not give me any rights of my ancestors when I was coming up. So yeah, they definitely have an impact on the psyche of those of us who have been oppressed and our ancestors have been oppressed by what these statues represent. So it's not just a statue, but it's what it really represents. And for people who want to keep the statue and talk about it as a part of history, well, that's the ugliest part of history of this country. And for us to say that we want to lift up our ugliness, that is crazy to me. That's absolutely crazy.
So, as you will recall, my brother, that on April 3rd, and that rainy night, Martin Luther King gave the Bend to the Mountaintop speech, right? And that there are those who, aside from all the other things that were said about what King was doing that put a target on his back, was part of, one of them was also going, he said, first of all, he's at a union rally.
The garbage workers.
And for the garbage workers, in terms of looking at that time and where we are now, in terms of the coalition of Black trade unionists, and in terms of the African-Americans and the labor movement and racism in this country, what's your analysis? What did we learn from those lessons we can apply today?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have come at least a long way. I mean, I can remember coming up in the movement when I was the only Black person and the youngest person in the room where decisions were being made, right? And it was because I was blessed to have union leadership within my own union, CSEA Local 1000, AFSCME, that were not afraid of bringing up this young Black kid that had a big mouth and wouldn't shut up. And I had five elderly Black women in the movement that kept me on track, right? And made sure that I knew what I needed to know, that I was where I needed to be, that nobody, you know, put roadblocks up for me. So that was a blessing for me. But I looked around and seeing so many spaces that could be filled with people of color. And now, you know, a few decades later, now I see my international union that has a Black president. I see a CWA with a Black president. I see AFGE with a Black president. I see the biggest union that's not even a part of AFL, NEA, with a Black, I mean, so we have so many Black leaders at the top of the movement now, and in second spots, in Secretary Treasurer positions, that, and at the AFL with Fred Redmond in the number two spot, that has a lens, a racial lens at the things that we are looking at within the movement. We can't help to, but to bring all of who we are to whatever positions we have in this movement. So now, before we would have to say, how do we get the message that, Black people need X to our president? Or how do we get this? Now our president is one who in many cases have been through what we've been through, who've walked through the racist doors early on in the labor movement and in society, and had to learn to live with that struggle. So we have come a long way, but we have not yet attained, right? We have, there's still a long way to go. We have still got many unions, and you see it just like I do, at least at the AFL-CIO Executive Council meeting. It's still not as dark, and it's still not as enough estrogen in the room to really reflect the real demographics of our movement. So that is where CBTU is on these issues, as well as, I would say, the other constituency groups. We are going to continue to be the conscience of the labor movement. We are going to continue to make sure the issues of Black workers, of brown workers, of women workers, of LGBTQ workers, of Hispanic workers, of Asian workers is on the table and are discussed and are addressed, because and it's a selfish reason for us, but it's selfish also for the labor movement. Look, we know and we've seen the demographics of those that are want to come into this movement are young, Black and brown and women, right? So if those are the people coming into the movement, either the movement is going to get themselves ready, or these folks are just going to come in and do like young folks do anyway. They're going to come in and take over and make this union movement something different than we even thought it could be. So we're either going to meet them where they are and help bring them in, or they're going to drag us somewhere else.
Do you have a favorite labor song and why? Which was your favorite? I mean, not your all time, but what's one off the top of your head?
Solidarity Forever.
Because
I truly believe that if we have true solidarity, we can go great places and do great things. But as long as we're separated, we're not going to move.
When I look at you, I look into the eyes of the ancestors, the people who worked in the fields or the mines or the factories, the works in the homes of others, the ones who sweated day and night without weekends or sick days or holidays. We are the survivors, and we have work to be done. Because in our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of armies magnified a thousandfold. We will bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old. You can join hands. For the union makes us strong. And that's why we sing Solidarity Forever. Solidarity Forever. Solidarity Forever. For the union makes us strong. Go in peace, go in love, go in solidarity.
Something is happening in Memphis, something is happening in our world. The nation is sick. Trouble is in the land, confusion all around. That's a strange statement. But I know somehow that only when it is dark enough can you see the stars. Something is happening in our world. The masses of people are rising up. And wherever they are assembled today, whether they are in Johannesburg, South Africa,
Nairobi, Kenya, Accra, Ghana, New York City, Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, or Memphis, Tennessee, the cry is always the same. We want to be free. We have been forced to a point where we are going to have to grapple with the problems that men have been trying to grapple with through history, but the demands didn't force them to do it. Survival demands that we grapple with them. We aren't engaged in any negative protest and in any negative arguments with anybody. We are saying that we are determined to be men. We are determined to be people. We are saying that we are God's children. And if we are God's children, we don't have to live like we are forced to live. Now, what does all of this mean in this great period of history? It means that we've got to stay together. We've got to stay together and maintain unity. You know, whenever Pharaoh wanted to prolong the period of slavery in Egypt, he had a favorite formula for doing it. What was that? He kept the slaves fighting among themselves. But whenever the slaves get together, something happens in Pharaoh's court, and he cannot hold the slaves in slavery. When the slaves get together, that's the beginning of getting out of slavery. Now let us maintain unity. Secondly, let us keep the issues where they are. The issue is injustice. The issue is the refusal of Memphis to be fair and honest in its dealings with its public servants who happen to be sanitation workers. Now we've got to keep attention on that. All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. Now let me say as I move to my conclusion that we've got to give ourselves to this struggle until the end. Nothing would be more tragic than to stop at this point in Memphis. We've got to see it through. Be concerned about your brother. You may not be on strap, but either we go up together or we go down together. Let us develop a kind of dangerous unselfishness. One day a man came to Jesus. He wanted to raise some questions about some vital matters of life. At points, he wanted to trick Jesus.
That's right.
And show him that he knew a little more than Jesus knew and throw him off base. Now, that question could have easily ended up in a philosophical and theological debate. But Jesus immediately pulled that question from midair and placed it on a dangerous curve between Jerusalem and Jericho. He talked about a certain man who fell among thieves. You remember that a Levite and a priest passed by on the other side. They didn't stop to help him. Finally, a man of another race came by. He got down from his beast, decided not to be compassionate by proxy. But he got down with him, administered first aid, and helped the man in need. Jesus ended up saying this was the good man, this was the great man, because he had the capacity to project the eye into the bow and to be concerned about his brother. The first question that the Levite asked was, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by, and he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? That's the question before you tonight. Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to my job? Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to all of the hours that I usually spend in my office every day and every week as a pastor? The question is not if I stop to help this man in need, what will happen to me? The question is, if I do not stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to them? That's the question. Let us rise up tonight with a greater readiness. Let us stand with a greater determination. And let us move on in these powerful days, these days of challenge, to make America what it ought to be. We have an opportunity to make America a better nation. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
You're listening to the Labor Heritage Power Hour on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice. You just heard excerpts from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final speech at Mason Temple in Memphis, Tennessee, the night of April 3, 1968. He was assassinated the next day. Before that, we heard our very own Elise Bryant at the AFGE Women's Fair Practices Luncheon at the 2015 Grassroots and Mobilizations Legislative Conference. And before that, Terry Melvin, president of CBTU, the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, on changing the name of the AFL-CIO's Gompers Room to the Solidarity Room.
Up next, a preview of this year's DC Labor Film Fest, which launches on May Day. We visit with AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center Director Todd Hitchcock and Abby Algar, Director of AFI Programming.
All right, so Todd, Abby, welcome to the Labor Heritage Power Hour. We're here to talk about the 2024 DC Labor Film Fest. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be back with you.
So we have a really interesting mix as usual. We've got some classics. We've got some new stuff, and we've got some stuff that's I think we can safely say is out on the cutting edge. Why don't we go ahead and start out with opening night on May 1st. Todd, you want to tell us about what we've got?
Sure. So on what has now become kind of our traditional opening night for the DC Labor Film Fest of May the 1st, happens to land on a Wednesday this year, we're going to open up this year's festival with a film called The Old Oak, which is written and directed by Ken Loach. And I'm hoping, trusting that for your listeners, that's a familiar name from many films over many years previously, including many that have screened as part of the festival. But this one definitely counts as a labor film, but it comes at it through an interesting way. So it's a depressed Northern England town so far. So Ken Loach, I get it. But there's a flare up within the community regarding some recently relocated Syrian refugees, a couple of families and the neighborhood, the changing neighborhood. Who are the faces in the neighborhood now? Do they socialize or not in the traditional modes of the older and aging long-term residents? The Old Oak is the name of the local pub, which has seen better days. The story centers there and kind of has a moment of turning a corner and becoming a little more hopeful that maybe this can still be a place where the community comes together and the new version of the community. I won't say anything more because there's still a lot of twists and turns beyond that, but turns out some of the community are open to the new neighbors, but they're up against problems from within the community and those who are not. And as they debate opening the back room of the pub for the first time in decades, it turns out there's this whole mini museum to the 70s and the miners' strikes. And it's a really terrific moment in the film, alongside the pub owner and sort of the community leader of the new Syrian residents, their relationship and negotiations and trying to bring the sides together. It's a really lovely film. And now apparently it is officially Ken Loach's final film because he's recently announced his retirement, which we've kind of been there before, but this seems like this is really the one.
For you.
All right, lad.
How come they're getting all that stuff?
I've lost everything. I've left a war zone.
She's taking your photo there.
You better delete that photo. They're just kids, man. Let them get in the house and get settled, man. I'm really sorry that happened. Can't say I'm surprised. If you hear the stuff that come out within the pub.
This has become a dumping ground, lads.
We've been in this village all our lives, and we're supposed to share it with that lot. We don't even know them.
Thank you for your kindness when we arrived. I really appreciate it. My name is Yara, by the way. What's yours?
Tommy Joe Ballantyne. Do you mind me asking? Are you all right?
When I was a little girl, I wanted to be a photographer and travel the world.
If you've got a moment, you'll come back to the pub with me. I wanted to show you the photographs in here. A whole way of life, just gone forever.
When you eat together, you stick together.
My mother always said that.
Some of the locals are struggling too.
Everywhere's closed. Even the school's gone. We can't even look after our own.
Just one from back worse, isn't it?
Imagine if all the families mix and start to eat together. If you eat together, you stick together.
God, what?
God.
The village, the Old Oak.
We need this.
It's like a bloody refugee camp.
Watch your mouth, Paul. It's not charity. This is solidarity. This is about we do something together.
It takes strength to build something new. It takes strength to build something beautiful. Shukran. Do you know what shukran means? It means thank you.
Shukran.
Shukran.
Just before we move on, for the many Ken Loach fans out there, did you want to hit some of them? I don't think we've shown every Ken Loach film, but pretty close.
We've certainly shown the big ones, the big and recent ones, like Daniel Blake from a few years back, and Sorry We Missed You as well, not that long ago. I mean, Bread and Roses going a little further back, and then actually, last year we screened his documentary Spirit of 45, right, which was from 2013, but it had a new release and restoration for the anniversary of it. So we got that in last year. So definitely in the Ken Loach business over here.
And I think one of the things about Ken Loach is that even though he is so specifically English and having been in those kinds of pubs. And in fact, I happened to have seen this film in England when Lisa and I were there last fall. So actually to go to a London theater and see the film was very special. But there are also issues that really are relevant elsewhere. This film particularly is relevant to what's going on in this election year. And one of the major issues, which has to do with, you know, attitude towards immigrants, which is a global issue, but I think is particularly resonating this year. And I found watching the film, like I was looking at it. I mean, I always feel like I want to show a Ken Loach film because he's always class conscious. But I thought, you know, this issue of immigrants is something that resonates for us in the United States in 2024.
Absolutely. And for those listening who either have already seen the film or plan to see the film when we screen it on May 1. That's the top line. It's about immigration in this moment of time, specifically happens to be a depressed Northern England town. But you can't not see how the specifics translate to other countries, including the U.S. 100%. And, also, just the way it's talked about and the way sort of sound bites and propagandistic versions of what is or isn't going on get passed around. That's definitely in the film as well. But at the same time, there's still a labor component, not just that it's class conscious. It is, but in his body of work, he has some films that are 100% labor subject, labor films. But even the ones that you don't first think of that, there's still a component there because they're just so well grounded in people's lives and livelihoods and struggles.
Coming up on May 6th, we always have a classic in our series. And that's partly because of who the Labor Film Fest is, but it's also a bit of a nod to what you at AFI are committed to, Todd.
Modern Times, starring Charlie Chaplin and directed by Charlie Chaplin and written and produced by Charlie Chaplin. So presumably everyone's got a base level name recognition for Charlie Chaplin. Something to know about: Modern Times was made in 1936. And for those of you who think back of silent films becoming sound films and the jazz singer in 1920, what was it, seven and all that? Silent films were gone, but Charlie Chaplin was such in a class of one superstar, international superstar, that he was able to persist a little bit longer than everybody else. And City Lights is in 1931, I think it is. Modern Times is 1936. So he, that just to point out for the listeners how unusual it was that Hollywood is almost 10 years into the sound era and he's still doing it his old school way. Now the music and the sound effects, something he didn't necessarily have before, but he does on this film, are now on the soundtrack. So it's a sound film, but it's done in completely the silent style that he was doing from decades past. And that's just a curiosity of history that I wanted to pass along to people. It's as good as anything he did in the silent era proper. It's hilarious. And yes, he works in a factory, and yes, he gets caught in the gears in an iconic, very, wonderful cartoonish scene, but it actually has some moments of, huh, this is actually like a semi-realistic labor setting, an issue being illuminated here. And it's funny. So I hope that sounds like a fun night at the movies to people, because it certainly is.
Section 5, speeder up, 4-1. Speed, 4-7. Back. Section 5, more speed, 4-7.
Again, just before we move on, Todd, the thing that I was thinking about, sort of reflecting, it's always amazed me, you know, how modern times for a film as old as it is, you know, how it has held up over the years. But then the thing that I was reflecting on, I want to get your thoughts, and Abby, feel free to jump in if you have thoughts on it as well, but you know, we just went through last year several huge strikes over artificial intelligence. I'm sure, like me, you've tried using ChatGPT, and I got a thing today from my photo software that now says I can swap my face into somebody, you know, to any race I want, which is really kind of freaking me out. But I'm thinking that, you know, yes, modern times is dealing with factory work, which is not so much what we're dealing with, but isn't AI just a modern version of that, or am I reaching?
I don't know. Let me punch that into ChatGPT and get for an answer.
Well played, sir. Well played.
I had to work that in somehow. Yes. I think you're right on with that. I mean, we've gone the exponential leap that in modern times it's machinery. You know, so it's analog, and we're turning people into machines, as in moving parts and mechanization and assembly lines. And now, through the frightening power of computer chips and computer programming, we're creating something that's, in some sense, so much more faster and more powerful in terms of data manipulation and outputs of those programs, that it's, oh, you can go home now because your job is fully automated. And not just the move this over here kind of definition of automation, but now it's starting to get into things that we associate as being creative or editorial, or, you know, let's just go ahead and say white collar work. So yeah, it's part of it is maybe the sensitivity that it's a white collar thing, not a blue collar thing. But I also think that weighing one technology versus another, we're in a very different area.
Well, I mean,
and far reaching.
Let's be clear. This is also into your wheelhouse, because, you know, one of the strikes, or several of the strikes last year, were by Hollywood, actors. We talked to them, you know, on our show. And they were being asked, forced sometimes, to sign waivers. They would be scanned, and then these scans would be used. So this is, you know,
That's a great example. So sort of beyond the sort of headline and sort of not very in-depth version of AI, what does AI mean, and when are they going to have robots and all that? Yeah, the idea that the real nuts and bolts of it, that rather than say I need crowd shots for 6 days of work and I'm going to hire enough people to have a crowd, I can hire that crowd for 1 day of work because I'm going to replicate the image and save on the budget. And of course, everyone wants to save where they can, but it's kind of frightening to think that that's what it actually looks like for people who get their livelihood from acting. I'm not the stars, not the stars who are top lining the film and bringing home millions of dollars for a movie, but the hundreds and hundreds of other people who will go gig to gig and, you know, this is their livelihood. They're not necessarily getting rich doing it. And they're literally losing out on what would be days of work because the technology can allow this. So that's where we are right now with these kind of negotiations. That's why we had the SAG strike last summer.
Or the screenwriters who, you know, the executives are like, oh, I can just put in, you know, give me this plot and, you know, and then we'll just use you for punch up and they're getting rid of writer's rooms. We did a whole series on that. So this is really, I would not have predicted that this would have been in your world a couple of years ago.
It very much is. And it's not, yeah, it's not down the road. It's already the sticking points for contracts. So, you know, for the moment, the contracts pushed back on that, not wholly, but not 100%, but they established a line. But what's the debate going to look like at the next go around?
So come see Modern Times to get a little inkling of that.
Abby, well, they have a laugh because we need it.
I know. Abby, anything to add to that?
I mean, I think the fact it's a comedy and, you know, a satire is fantastic. And we have a few of those in this year's festival that I think are kind of interrelated. I mean, I think you could maybe, I'm going to say something that's maybe wild, it might be too much, but you could maybe even draw a line between Modern Times and Office Space, which we are screening also.
I like it.
I feel like there's a connection. I mean, you've got kind of the dehumanizing technology in you know, in that workplace as well, the endless spreadsheets and computers and, you know, all that stuff, which is, you know, something that we all deal with as well in our day-to-day lives. So yeah, I think it's all interconnected, and this is a great example of how, you know, how comedy and satire can feed into the conversation around these issues.
Nice connection. I like it. All right. Next, on Wednesday, May 8th, we're showing the first in a series of foreign labor films. Again, it's been a staple of this series since year one. And again, I think a real calling card for AFI, bringing these kinds of films to the screen. Abby, why don't you tell us about In the Isles? And I'm not going to try the German.
No, me neither. No, it's okay. We'll go with In the Isles. But yes, this is a German film. It's actually from 2018, so it's relatively new. And I think we've been wanting to show this film since 2018 in this festival, and for whatever reason, it hasn't worked out. But then this year, we decided this was the year because two of the stars of this film, Franz Rogowski and Sandra Hüller, are essentially, you know, the most famous German actors in the world right now. At the time, you know, when they were making In the Isles, you know, they were relatively well known in Germany, but certainly not necessarily outside of the international film community. But now they're big stars, so it's a great time to bring this one back. It's essentially set in a big giant supermarket, and Franz Rogowski's character takes a job doing the night shift, restocking shelves in the drinks department, I think, and learning from, you know, an old hand in the department, learning the ropes and how to use all the machinery and all this kind of stuff. And it's a romance. He bonds or takes a shine to one of his co-workers, who's played by Sandra Hüller, who, of course, was in two Oscar-winning films this year, Anatomy of a Fall and The Zone of Interest. So very, very at the top of her game right now, and is also great in this film. So there's the kind of romance aspect of it, but also kind of like the everyday, you know, behind the scenes look at what it's like working in one of these big stores, and the kind of crew that is there, and the solidarity between people doing, you know, some of these jobs that are maybe a little tedious to say the least, and maybe not appreciated by all of us, the time and effort that goes into all of the things that we can buy on Amazon and have in a second. I kind of see this like almost like an Amazon warehouse a little bit, looking back on it. But it's a supermarket, but, you know, one of those gigantic ones that sells essentially everything. So, yeah, I think it's a really nice look into this crew of workers' lives and a nice romance. And there's of course, comedy and, yeah, some humor to it. So I think a great time to bring it back and some interesting themes in there as well.
Todd, anything to add?
Yeah, Indengagen is the German name. I will dare.
Thanks, Todd.
In the aisles. Yeah, like Abby said, really happy that we're including it this year. When it first came out, the timing just wasn't on our side. I think it was a Berlin premiere, and we had already basically planned the festival for that particular year. And but you know what? It's as if it was the right thing to do to wait until now. And now these two stars are much better known. In the case of Hula, she's Oscar nominated as well. It's great that we have another chance to present the film to folks, and I hope that they'll enjoy it. And I just want to underscore one more aspect of it. It really has some sweet comedy mixed in along the way with what this workplace culture is, and it's a really likable film. So I hope people will check it out.
Willkommen in der Nacht, Kollegen.
Eine Abteilung, ein Stapler. Und wir können nicht so gut mit den Konserven.
Kann ich deinen Stapler mal kurz?
Tut mir leid, Wolfgang.
Aber dann komm ich nächstes Mal wieder und bettel.
Staplerkonflikte. You know it's hard to think you're still losing when your future.
You're listening to the Labor Heritage Power Hour on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice.
We just heard from AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center Director Todd Hitchcock and Abby Algar, Director of AFI Programming, with a preview of this year's DC Labor Film Fest, which launches on May Day. Tickets and the full schedule are available now at laborheritage.org, where you'll also find all the latest labor arts and culture news and events across the country, laborheritage.org.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day workers at the Hershey Candy Plant in Hershey, Pennsylvania, sat down. CIO organizers for the new United Chocolate Workers Union reported that anywhere from 2,000 to 2,400 workers were on strike. Hershey was a company town where streets were named Chocolate and Coca Avenue. Housing was built for workers, and the company funded public education and transit service. But the company also sought to monitor and control workers' behavior on their off time and showed favoritism in hiring and wages. The Great Depression created dire conditions even in the sweetest place on earth. Hours and bonuses had been cut. Workers grew increasingly frustrated with production speed up and unpredictable work schedules, all while Hershey still drew handsome profits. The company initially raised wages after meeting with the union, but then laid off the organizers 3 months later. That's when the workers shut off their machines and occupied the plant. The company refused to negotiate unless the workers left. By April 7th, dairy farmers became incensed at the loss of income. They mobilized with anti-union company forces to storm the factory and drive the strikers out. Organizers had agreed to end the strike in order to resume negotiations and avert violence. But the anti-union forces attacked the sit-downers with bats, whips, clubs, and hammers. Three CIO organizers were singled out and severely beaten. Governor George Earle condemned the attack and blamed the county sheriff for suppressing labor rather than preventing mob rule. The strike was smashed. Attempts to install a company union failed soon after. Hershey would be one of the first candy companies to be organized when the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers International Union won recognition 2 years later. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the Labor Heritage Power Hour. If you've got suggestions for guests or topics for future shows, drop us a note. info@laborheritage.org. The Labor Heritage Power Hour is a proud founding member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network.
Today's show is produced by me, Chris Garlock, engineered by Mike Nasella and Kalia Chapman, right here on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice.
Thanks so much for listening to the Labor Heritage Power Hour,
the art and soul of the American labor movement.
From WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Thursday, April 4th. Here are some headlines. The Israeli strike on an aid convoy in Gaza that killed 7 workers with World Central Kitchen is hampering efforts to address a hunger crisis in the territory, with aid groups saying they are being more cautious about making deliveries, and at least 2 are suspending operations. In a statement yesterday on X, the International Committee of the Red Cross said that humanitarian relief organizations are unable to work safely in the besieged Gaza Strip in light of the destruction of hospitals and the targeting of humanitarian workers. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel deeply regrets the incident, while the IDF said the strike was the result of a misidentification. The 3 World Central Kitchen vehicles were clearly marked, and their movements were known to the Israeli military. In domestic news, a Manhattan judge yesterday rejected former President Donald Trump's attempt to delay the start of his New York hush money trial. Trump asked to delay the trial set for August 15th until the Supreme Court rules on the issue of presidential immunity. In denying the request, Judge Juan Merchan said it was untimely and that Trump's lawyers had months to raise the issue before they filed their motion in March. In the case, Trump is charged with 34 felony counts of falsification of business records in a scheme during the 2016 presidential campaign to cover up an alleged affair. A man from the state of Washington was sentenced to more than 7 years in prison yesterday for his involvement in the January 6 U.S. Capitol riot in 2021. Taylor James Jonatakis, a self-described sovereign citizen, was convicted in November on 3 felony counts of obstruction of an official proceeding, assaulting officers, and civil disorder. During the sentencing, Judge Royce Lamberth said videos showed Jonatakis playing a leadership role during the riot. He also made a point to emphasize the dangers of political violence. Quote, "This cannot become normal. We as a society, as a community, and as a country cannot normalize the events of January 6th. Close quote. And family members of the late Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. are in Memphis today, where the civil rights leader was assassinated, to mark the 56th anniversary of his murder. King family members said they were going to Memphis to draw attention to what they see as a rising threat of political violence today. Speaking to Axios, Martin Luther King III said civility in politics is diminishing and he worries that more lives will be lost unless the nation recommits itself to nonviolence, as his father preached. The civil rights leader was visiting Memphis in 1968 to help sanitation workers rally for better wages and safer working conditions, and delivered what would become known as his "I've Been to the Mountaintop" speech the day before he was killed. And in weather today, in Washington, D.C., it is 54 degrees under fair skies with rain likely after 3 p.m. In New York City, it is 46 degrees under fair skies with rain possible this evening. For WP